Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a fortnightly podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. He's here. And this week we've got special guest E. Durbin. Hello, E.
Oh, it's very good to be here.
Good to have you. So, E, I'm almost lost to words to how to introduce you because you're kind of like a, you're one of these figures in the Python community that I've seen and been like, you know, major cornerstone of everything that goes on. So that's I'm almost blushing.
So infrastructure
now.
At Python, right? That's the quick take. So that means PyPI, python.org. We'll get into all that. That's a lot of what you do, pretty much. Well, not you tell us how single-handedly that is, but my sense is you drive a lot of that, and that's truly internet scale. We often joke about Django and sites trying to do things internet scale, but you know, running PyPI, for example, that is truly internet scale.
Yeah, well, it is a portion of my full-time job, and that is supporting, you know, a pretty large swath of volunteers that are also take part. But yeah, we do. There are three people who are really, really, really actively involved in PyPI itself. So it does end up backstopping on me, you know, occasionally.
Well, very modest of you. Yeah, Carlton, sort of like you with Django and releases.
No, that's Marius and releases. He's the, you know, he's the backstop.
Yeah, we're recording this the day Django 3.2 came out. So that's the
context. By the way, congratulations.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, it's Hacker News. You know, they had their annual, oh, Django's exists and it's cool. And
I foolishly glanced at the comments on that thread. And it was, you know, the first comment, a couple of comments. And then you get into, oh, you know, I like Flask. And then it's like, no, you mustn't use Flask. You must use this.
It starts with micro frameworks. And then you get into JavaScript is better. And then you get into Rust.
And it's like, why did I look at the comments?
I'm very lucky to have friends who look at that website for me and help me know what I need to actually go and read. So I try to stay away.
Oh, ditto. I don't have an account anymore. I only glance once a week now at this point. That goes for social media for me in general too. I've pulled away because I take a glance, but, and that feels okay, but anything more than a couple minutes and it's not good.
Yeah, once in a while, there's something posted there that actually gets any amount of praise. And most recently, it was actually related to PyPI, and it was when we rolled out the implementation of their token scanning. So basically, if you accidentally upload one of your API tokens to GitHub, PyPI will now revoke it almost immediately. And the people on Hacker News seemed to like that. So it was oddly satisfying to see PyPI and not something relating to all manner of angry thoughts. So
I've got this terrible thing come across now because when I was uploading Django 3.2 today and I, you know, Twine upload and it goes up and it's like legacy dot something. I'm like, I've got to update a setting somewhere. Now I've got you in front of me. I'm going to be like, God, can you open up my config and help me sort it out?
I'm hoping that was probably Twine or setup tools, whatever you're using to upload. So.
But it was using the legacy endpoint, and I must go into the, you know, the docs and find the what URL string do I need to change to get it to use the latest one? Because otherwise,
well, it's actually the same implementation. So the reason that warning is there is so that eventually when we do change the implementation, we can use a different URL. So at the very least, you're not missing out on any features. You're just talking to the wrong URL.
Yeah, well, that's fine. I think my feeling at the time was, or A, I must address that, but B, if it was serious, it would be in a different color.
if it was serious, it would just give you an error and say, it's too late. You've waited too long.
Yeah. I'll fix it then.
So a lot of podcasts don't go deep on technical stuff, but since the three of us who we are, I really want to do that today. But maybe can we quickly get your backstory? So how does one get to this position with the Python organization? You were telling us you're based in Cleveland. I believe you went to school there. Are you from there as well originally?
I grew up in Southwest Ohio, and I came to Cleveland for school. And then I briefly moved to San Diego after school because it was one of the only jobs I could find that would help me pay for those dastardly student loans. But I went to school for physics and math and graduated into a recession that we're all pretty familiar with. The junkyard job that I had for the first like 6 months after I graduated wasn't paying for things. And I took a job with an appraisal management company. And I was just supposed to do like magical spreadsheet things for like their business reporting. Because physics and math. Yeah. I wasn't very good at it and pretty quickly ended up just through, you know, hobby type interactions with computers over the years and just being decent with configuring them and such. I ended up sort of a sysadmin for, you know, sort of a standard cubicle farm type thing. And that company had like an in-house programming startup that was doing a pretty neat piece of software. And so the lead for that looked at me and said, "You went to school for physics and math?" I said, "Yes." And so Kanan said, "Well, you can learn PHP. So we'll just go ahead and have you start programming with us since you're kind of done with automating all the workstations and stuff." And the first time I ever wrote Python was at that job. And it was because I searched for how to programmatically access stored procedures from a MySQL database. And lo and behold, I ended up on PyPI looking at the MySQL library. And I was like, this is the first thing I found that can connect to MySQL. I might as well use it. And that's when I wrote Python for the first time. So I eventually desperately wanted to come back to Cleveland. I got a job here doing sort of Linux sysadmin type things, and continuing to write Python to automate stuff. And through a local community and like the local Python user group, I was introduced to an opportunity to do part-time work as a sysadmin for the PSF. I took that part-time job, and that's how I got introduced to PyPI and Python.org and such. Pretty much immediately quit billing and submitted almost no invoices. And pretty quickly turned into mostly just a volunteer at the infrastructure and did that for, a number of years. And, that is really, to me, how I got introduced to so many people in the community I was volunteering on the infrastructure, which covers, all manner of technical concerns for the community, as well as community concerns. So I would interact with the PyCon staff to help get the PyCon site going and things like that. And then just kept at it. And I mean, there's a ton of wonderful people that, all have a pretty common direction and goal. And they tend to be kind, and the community shows a lot of what's, in my opinion, the best of the software industry, or at least aspires to it. And so I kept on with that. And then years later, there became an opportunity, and I was offered a job at the PSF to take on, the infrastructure role. And I've been here, I guess, for it's either 2 or 3 years, and I should probably know. It'll be 3 years in June.
Wow. We had Eva on last week to talk about her own progression from part-time to full-time and sort of that side of things. It's sort of wild to think that the PSF was ever small, because in Django land, the Django Software Foundation, we look at Python, and Python Software Foundation is this Godzilla of a thing, but that's really pretty recent that outgrew the volunteer realm. And
yeah, I mean, I personally remember when the PSF really was just sort of Eva as far as full-time roles go. And so it has been interesting myself to watch it grow. And then, we just had a new person start recently. And so, my eyes light up because I'm learning so much about, the community and nonprofit operations side of things, if you will. So, I and community oriented in a lot of ways, but not necessarily in the way that the PSF is. And so it's been a really amazing opportunity to stretch my legs a little bit outside of just sort of sitting at a keyboard and pounding my head against it occasionally. And sometimes you actually get to talk to people or, interact with the community in a way that is not just via software. And it's been very rewarding.
And you have these office hours, or you've had them, because I think we first spoke 2 years ago or something like that when I was setting up a site, and Jeff Triplett recommended I get in touch with you around python.org, which is a Django site. And that was, so I guess my question is, do you still do that? Is that, that's something you did a lot of? Because it was very generous of you to just have open office hours.
The office hours were initiated during my time as the PyCon chair. And so this was before I was a PSF staff member. I was also a volunteer chairing PyCon. And a big aspect of that is, you know, I recognize the position that PyCon has in the community. But I also personally very much recognize the immense value in regional organizing. And so the office hours were a really good opportunity for me to provide, you know, that low intensity space to meet a lot of folks from, you know, different regions and different parts of the community that sometimes can't even make it to PyCon in person. I kept doing them for a while. I think I took it down about a year ago, as the stress of the current world circumstances, just became a little bit much for me. So it's actually, I appreciate the reminder, because it's something I probably am in a much better place to put back into service.
It's something I've been thinking of, actually, because I saw Simon Wilson said he's doing office hours for his data set project, and he's like, I really recommend this. And I was thinking, well, maybe I could squeeze one. How did you run it? Did you just like have a video call, or did people book a meeting, or did they?
I used a service that allowed for integration from my calendar to a set of slots that I'd predetermined to be like. Okay.
Yeah, I think it was it Calendly, or that's one of those.
Yeah.
It's one of those
ones.
Yeah,
I just tend to people would plug brand names, but yeah, it was Calendly.
Yeah. Okay.
And then I had that.
That's the way you do it, Carlton. Yeah, you just say this is when, and then someone. And I assume, actually, I don't know, on your end, can you sort of say no, like, what's the last minute someone can do it, right? Like, there must be some sort of.
Yeah, you can tell it, like, you can only schedule 24 hours or 7 days or whatever in advance. And then my favorite part is that you can say, don't allow for somebody to book, like, within 15 minutes of a previous thing ending or before another thing. So it's really nice, because you just open up the little windows and windows of time, and then it just sort of takes care of the rest, and you'll just get an email when somebody books it and it shows up in your calendar. And, you know, it's cool. I do recommend, some automation around it, because otherwise you'd be doing a lot of work to offer that up, and it would become probably more stressful than it's worth.
It's so funny that it works, I think, really well in a nonprofit or in a volunteer setting, but on the business side, I've had it used in the business side, and there it becomes more of it's totally a power move. It's like, who's going to set who, you know, someone will ask for a meeting, and they're like, here's my dates. And it's so nice, actually, when it's just like, okay, like, you want something from me, like, here's my calendar. It's so much simpler than in the MBA world, which I spent some time in. It sort of weirdly becomes this pissing match of sorts. So it's nice to hear that it doesn't have to be like that. I just have some scar tissue around that. As soon as someone would send me one, I was like, what?
There were a few times where people would schedule to try to sell me things or convince me to do weird yeah. stuff. But like, you just hang up on the call and go on with your day. Yeah,
right. One click.
Yeah. That wasn't worthwhile.
Right. Well, so can you talk about then so what is the scope of infrastructure? So I guess to me, I know PyPI, python.org, but there's more than that. How do you define it? And then in terms of what takes up your time?
Sure. So the PSF operates infrastructure both for the community. And so that would be a lot of the public facing stuff like python.org and PyPI and the wiki and the PyCon site and such. We also operate some infrastructure for our own operations. So internal sites for membership data and things like that. And then we also, in the last few years, have been either providing infrastructure or collaborating or supporting infrastructure for our fiscal sponsorees. So the PSF recently took on the ability for organizations who aren't quite big enough to be their own nonprofit but need that structure around, you know, the tax incentives and such to apply to be fiscal sponsorees. And so we have a couple of those. Like the most recent one is the Python Package Authority is the most recent fiscal sponsoree. And that allows that will allow them to, you know, do fundraising in a nonprofit sort of way. And we've already been supporting the PyPA infrastructure, so that's things like packaging.python.org and such. So it's realistically, you know, almost everything online on the python.org domain, as well as PyPI and a few other things. So, and then like really mundane things like who holds the registration for a given domain. So the PSF, you know, we make sure that these domains remain registered and that there are funds to renew them for a number of a number of smaller projects and things.
That all sounds very familiar.
Yeah. I guess the less than glamorous way to describe it is, you know, the PSF infrastructure is realistically here to make sure that the really boring, mundane things do get done. And, you know, occasionally, and it's exciting always, of course, there are opportunities to build out new things or improve or, you know, rebuild existing stuff. But there's a lot of running around to do to make sure that TLS certificates remain valid and such. And
with volunteers especially, right? I mean, we have that with Django cons, not to mention other things. There's, you know, quite a bit of that at the board level,
yeah,
Carlton level.
So. Well, but the ops team, you know, it's so there's Maris and I who are, you know, we're contracted, but the rest of it's all volunteers, and you know they're busy rebuilding servers, you know, on the weekend and all the rest of it. And it's like, you know,
amazing that it works. You know, it's sort of a bunch of people who, you know, swoop in when they need to, and then hopefully otherwise can kind of. I mean, they all have, you know, they don't get paid for it, so.
Right. Yeah, and so there's a lot of that, too. So facilitating various working groups, you know, a really active one is the documentation working group, so docs.python.org. You know, there's a lot going on behind the scenes there. And, you know, realistically, you know, it's my responsibility if infrastructure concerns of that have a problem. So whether it's the places where the code runs and such. But, you know, it is volunteers that push. Basically, all the forward progress that's visible is driven by volunteers yeah, most of the time. And then the infrastructure is ideally the thing that no one else is worried about unless they want to be.
Well, there's also the you know technical infrastructure. And then, as you were saying, just the infrastructure of a nonprofit or a community thing. I mean, we spoke obviously a lot with Eva about that, but so much of that is people don't think about in terms of, I mean, she mentioned, you know, going out for grants, and Python has built, the PSF is building up the capability to support those properly. I mean, those are things we can't do right now. And even the fundraising, Carlton spent quite a bit of time updating because Stripe changed their end of things, you know, donations to Django. It's been interesting to see GitHub sponsors. You know, GitHub is, I'm sure by the time this launches, they're going to have corporate sponsors as well, so they're making a big push there. And on the one hand, it's great because that's no easy thing to manage all that. But if it's Microsoft managing every nonprofit in the tech space, there's, I suppose, some concerns as well. But the demands are real and largely behind the scenes around both sides, the tech side, and then just running a nonprofit with software.
Yeah, and then there's keeping track of all the various ways that, you know, contributions come in. And so that's where, you know, the accounting team at the PSF has a lot of work to do because, you know, GitHub sponsors sound so good on paper from a I want to give money perspective. And it sounds so good from a I want to receive money perspective. But then there's the aspect of, oh, wait, but that's a whole nother reporting pipeline for contributions and such. So, yeah, the infrastructure aspects, like the non-technical infrastructure aspects are, yeah, I mean, there's just a number of systems and all sorts of things going on. And There's, I guess there probably is. It's like QuickBooks for accounting that takes care of all of that. That's where it all ends up, but it's getting there, right?
But no, I mean, yeah, it's just, it's non-trivial. I mean, there's, that's why you all have three accountants. Carlton, you were going to say
I was just going to say on the GitHub front that, you know, thinking, so I'm based in Europe and I'm in Spain called, my status is autónomo, like it's self-employed basically. It's, you know, a particular type of tax setup. But in order to have GitHub sponsors, I'd need to be able to identify the payers and with it, they'd have to have a tax number and all of these things. And it's none of that's available. And it's like, so literally I can't accept GitHub sponsorship money without breaking the you know, the European and Spanish tax laws. And it's like, so it's a nice idea, but the reality is it's not compatible with, you know.
Yeah, moving money internationally is difficult, that's for sure. You know, we've been really lucky. You mentioned them earlier, but we've been really lucky to facilitate a number of grants for improvements. And, you know, contracting the people who are most apt to do the work has meant, you know, international contractors. And that in and of itself is an amazing web of nonsense to cut through. So,
well, you know, so there's two Django fellows, Carlton and Marius, and each of them gets paid a different way in a different form manually. We can only imagine the scale Python's at. I didn't think about that sponsors thing, Carlton. You can't accept.
Yeah.
I don't know. What's an equivalent? Those like buy me a coffee things. Yeah, yeah. You couldn't do one of those.
Maybe you can if they've got the right collection. So you could set. The way you end up doing it is to set up a Stripe payment thing and you just get them to put in their actual details and they can do it there. But like these services where they try and make it easy, unless they're collecting the right data or they act as the seller of record, I think it's called, like the, you know, mm-hmm.
Yeah, like Gumroad does
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah. So Gumroad, Gumroad are the people doing the payment and they pay you a royalty. And so that's fine. You can do that. But if they're paying you directly, you have to collect all these details and, you know.
Well, I don't, yeah, not anyway, to get too legal, but I mean, I think that stuff is, you know, Stripe's improving what it automatically handles around taxes and all the rest. I mean, it's a slow process. It's also the case that with sales tax, like on books, for example, a lot of times, or digital goods, the rules only apply if you're at like a six-figure or above level. I mean, they recognize that it's impossible to enforce. So, you know, in the United States, you could argue that every state tries to get their hands on a digital transaction in some way. But, you know, it's basically, I mean, I've spent quite a bit of time trying to figure this out. There's whole services that will calculate online sales tax for you. And it's impossible to do. But it's largely, you know, only for transactions. I believe it's generally high six, seven figures before they even say you're supposed to try to do these things because it's, you know, nobody can. But anyways, it's a real concern.
It's difficult, right?
So try to stay away from it.
Yeah, yeah.
So E, I wanted to talk about PyPI, right? So I go pip install Django, and it goes and fetches it. And how on earth does that work? Because there's there's a server and it serves the files. But I mean, you know, in terms of that works reliably for how many people per day, and you know, how has that grown up and. You know.
Now this is a place where I'm always happy to plug. Realistically, PyPI exists as reliably as it does because of Fastly, our CDN provider. Fastly is extremely generous in the amount of traffic that they handle for us. So this is on the petabyte scale per month now. And so, you know, PyPI's backends are by no means small, but relative to the amount of traffic we do at the edge, they are minuscule. So for 97 plus percent of PIP interactions with PyPI, you are probably receiving a page from the simple index from Fastly and then receiving like in their cache and then receiving the actual file itself, especially for a project like Django, from the cache. At the edge. Behind the scenes, you know, we're also really fortunate to have amazing infrastructure support from Amazon Web Services and Google Cloud Platform. So the files themselves are stored in Google Cloud objects, access logs, and not necessarily access logs, I guess. A better way to put that is access statistics are stored in Google BigQuery. So you can go find out all sorts of amazing stuff about who's been downloading Django from BigQuery now.
And that's accurate, because a couple of years ago, I remember trying to look into this, and the data wasn't really available.
It's been improved dramatically from work by Donald Stuft and Dustin Ingram in Linehall is the project. And so that takes the actual access logs from the files, as well as access logs from the simple index, and converts them into anonymized records in BigQuery that are as accurate as we can possibly imagine.
And that's aggregating from the edges, from the CDN.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fantastic.
Yeah, so simple index access is probably the most accurate, because you have to talk to that. With the advent of pip caching, the actual file downloads have been minimized somewhat. But yeah, so you can read more about that at packaging.python.org if you search for PyPI access or PyPI usage statistics or something.
Okay, yeah,
I'll find it and put it in the show notes. I think I've seen that article before.
Yeah, and then we have 12 to 15 decently sized EC2 instances running Kubernetes in Amazon that run a handful of services that compose PyPI. So there's the main one, which is the web app that you see and interact with. And then we also have the application that handles turning or enforcing TLS for all images that are accessed. And then we have another service that does URL magic, I guess. I don't know how to describe it. It makes URLs work if you try to access a URL for a package file in a way that's outdated.
So there's probably a dictionary of some kind to match those up.
Conveyor does. It also serves those old docs.pythonhosted.org. And then it turns the way that PyPI files used to be stored were slash first letter, slash project name, slash, and then a bunch of files. And so you used to be able to reliably say, I want to go get this file. I don't even know its name, but I know that it's the project at this version. And so you just guess. Because of the scale of PyPI, that had to change, because S3 buckets and Google Cloud buckets and stuff don't deal with these sorts of file hierarchies. So now it's slash packages slash a bunch of hash gibberish, and then the actual package itself. And so that, you kind of want people to be able to access the file the way they used to. So Conveyor exists for that purpose as well. And then we try to maintain, I think a big reason why PyPI has done as well as it has growing is right off the bat, Fastly. That takes a lot of problems off of our shoulders as far as just the sheer volume. And then otherwise, we've made really boring choices around technology for how to get to where we are. And so we're still just using, a moderately powerful Postgres instance and some Redis and, unfortunately not Django, but a very Django-inspired implementation of Pyramid. Donald has often said that he accidentally built a bunch of what he knew from Django into Warehouse to make Pyramid work more like Django. And then just GUnicorn and Nginx and
keep it simple.
Just sort of all works. We've done a lot of learning on how to push what's there to the scale as well. And, things break and they'll always continue to break, but simple choices and trying to keep our footprint small.
Can you talk about the growth? I mean, maybe it's in that where you referenced, I've seen the charts of you know, just downloads from PyPI in the last couple of years, and it's almost exponential.
And how much of that is CI? Is it people?
Yeah, that's Carlton's thing. Yeah.
No, but is Python that much more popular? Because it is much more popular. Or is it like, you know, that we're all running 58 GitHub Action jobs every time we...
Yeah, I'm not... I guess I've never seen an analysis, and I've never like been able to perform an analysis to pinpoint one thing. And it also depends on what we talk about when we talk about growth. So if we just look at requests to the service, or if we just look at bandwidth, or if we just look at number of projects and stuff, you know, there's sort of different axes, right? When it comes to bandwidth, our biggest bandwidth growth has been in data science and machine learning projects and the binary wheels that support, you know, computing on GPUs, right? Like that's contributed massively to our bandwidth. When we look at requests, I would assume that like requests to the service, a lot of that is driven by CI, you know, of course. Some of the bandwidth probably is because caching in CI is an unsolved problem, it would seem.
Yeah.
And then, you know, one of my favorite metrics to look at is new project registration. That growth, I think, is probably the closest you could get to the popularity of the language, right? So the more people are publishing new and novel projects, I think that shows a healthy ecosystem. That growth has been pretty steady, all things considered, and accelerated significantly due to like code generation things, right? You know, so, you know, some people like their one repository might create hundreds of sub projects, right? But that's not super common. I think data science and machine learning have been, you know, the most obvious growth aspect for both Python and PyPI in my assessment.
Okay, and talking about registering new projects, one thing that was crossing my mind in the last week or so was about namespaces and like the sort of name collisions on PyPI. Is that a big issue, or is there moves in the ground to take, for instance, the Swift ecosystem, whereas they do it by URLs. So if you've got your repo URL, it's namespace per user kind of thing.
Sure. So the namespace issue has a couple of implications. As far as like when I hear that word, it's ringing some bells and turning some lights on. So one of the most recent conversations on namespacing has been around some of the, you know, the published, I don't know if you are, did either of you see the article about like dependency confusion?
Yeah, there was a thing about poisoning dependencies and packages which perhaps were malicious, named very similar to existing packages. So
yeah, or named precisely like an internal package that isn't actually published to the index.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So, you know, it's interesting because you see these wonderfully named projects pop up on the index and you're like, that wasn't taken? How? We're working with arbitrary length strings of characters. And so the human mind will always come up with things like, you know, to fill out that space, I think. So from like exhausting the list of usable names on PyPI, I don't think namespacing is necessarily a big concern. But on these other aspects of, you know, provenance of a project, validity of a project, and safely managing installations at clients, I think namespacing has a lot of opportunity to help ease some of these concerns. And it is something that, you know, there's an open issue on the GitHub tracker for it, and it's something that, you know, we're really interested in pursuing and are hoping to be able to do so, you know, rather soon. So there's some really exciting announcements that do pertain to PyPI and packaging that are going to be coming through, I think, probably in the next week or so. So I would definitely recommend checking out the Python Software Foundation blog at pyfound.blogspot.com.
Yeah, I think Eva hinted at those as well. So, in fact, I think it'll be out by the time this airs. So I'll put a link to the PyPI news.
Awesome. So, you know, I think with time, we'll see a lot of these things develop, and we're really excited to have the chance to pursue like things of that scale. That's a rather big change to the ecosystem. That's a rather big change to the service. But we're excited the opportunity to be able to pursue those more consistently. So PyPI itself has seen a large amount of investment over the years. Mozilla funded, I'm sorry, Mozilla Foundation funded the launch of the rewrite of PyPI. Open Technology Fund funded some really big security improvements and user experience and internationalization improvements to PyPI. The Chan Zuckerberg Initiative and Mozilla again funded a bunch of work on PIP last year. But those, as amazing as the outcomes are, it does stink because it's just like, we get all of this done and then there's no more money or there's no more roadmap for what's to be done next. And so people sort of disperse back to what they were doing. But we're hoping.
Right. The maintenance is less fun than the greenfield.
Sure. So we're really excited to hopefully have, you know, improvements on that story, not just for PyPI, but for Python packaging more generally soon.
It's hard to create a roadmap when it's like, you know, there's a bit of momentum here, and then okay, well, that's finished, what do we do? Oh yeah, as you say, wander off and go back to what you're doing.
Yeah, and it's not common that somebody just sits down and says, I want to go through a months-long project as a volunteer to add a feature to a service, right? That's a huge commitment as a volunteer.
Yeah.
So you mentioned PIP. I wanted to ask you, so installing Python, I guess first, just personally, if you had a new computer, well, what operating system do you like to work on? So just you personally.
My desktop is macOS.
Okay. What do you use? PIP, PIPM? Like, you know, if you bought a brand new Mac and you're just going to install it from scratch, how would you do that? Because I was just updating my books on Django and being like, okay, here we go. Like, you know, there's four or five different ways to install Python. I'm curious what you personally do and then what you recommend if you get asked about it.
It's going to sound like propaganda, but it's not. I have been using the installers from python.org as long as I can remember. It is...
Well, I think that's now the, you know, certainly on Mac, Homebrew has its issues. Carlton and I were texting about this earlier. So that, you know, for someone who knows what they're doing, the installers...
No, but it's not even...
On both Windows and Mac would be the way to go.
It's not even know what you're doing. It's download, it's double-click the DMG file, it's run the installer. It's a fully packaged installer for you. Same on Python.
Yes, but Carlton, everyone, by the time they come to you, has clicked around and half-installed five different ways.
Yeah, okay.
And their path is messed up. And they're like, how do I fix my path?
Yeah, so I mean, My setup is this. I still work on projects that use various Python language or Python versions. I still have to worry about that. And so for a lot of environments, what I'm doing is a brand new computer gets like the latest 2.7, the latest like 3.6, 3.7, 3.8, 3.9, and soon 3.10, all installed. I set up I choose an arbitrary Python 3 to be like my main environment. That gets a pip install --user virtualenv and tox and a few other things. And then as I need the other Pythons, I create virtual environments for them explicitly. So I don't use like a helper. I probably should use
Do you use PyEnv?
No. Oh, yeah, I use Venv built into Pythons. Or if I'm using a Python that doesn't have Venv built in, I use virtualenv.
Maybe I'm not understanding. How do you, within the virtual environments, point to the different Pythons? I guess I'm very familiar with PyEnv for pointing to somewhere else.
Oh yeah, when you initiate a virtual environment or Venv, which is sort of like it's a very pared down implementation of virtual environment, you can specify an interpreter, and so the result that you get is an environment that once you source it or activate it, you're using that specific interpreter, and you have a empty site directory or empty site packages. So then whenever you reactivate that no matter what Python interpreter you're coming from or shell, whenever you reactivate that virtual environment, you'll get that same interpreter version and whatever dependencies you've installed.
Do you use, do you do much with Docker in terms of like team settings?
Yeah, we use a lot of Docker Compose and such for not just PyPI, but also for like some of the Python infrastructure as well. You know, it just alleviates so much of the concerns of reproducible environments. But the biggest pain point that I have had with Docker-based stuff is it is really not kind to contributors who don't have monster computers.
Yeah.
And so that's an open problem in my book around like how do you help?
Yeah, you need 16 gigs of RAM basically to run anything.
Yeah, it's troublesome. And so in the past, when we've done sprints on PyPI at like PyCon, or just when I've been trying to like collaborate with folks elsewhere, you know, there are people who are very excited and motivated to contribute, but are almost literally unable because their computer can't run Docker or because it doesn't have enough, you know, resources. So I don't know the answer, though. If anybody does, please let me know.
I think that's a big issue, is that there are, you know, just so many millions of people out there that have got a computer that's 2, 3, 4, 5 years old that's got some version of Python installed on it. And, you know, they don't necessarily know what, and they don't necessarily have the technical chops to download the latest one and update. And you still want to be able to say, look, you can get started, you can work, you can do, and, you know, and they'll learn the harder stuff as they get on. But if the barrier to entry is you've got to have the latest shiny and it's got to be maxed out to the top, that's not what it's about.
Yeah.
I wonder, I mean, I run this site installpython3.com to try to sort of help. Go look at it. It's not aesthetically amazing, but I'm about to update it again for this very problem because there's so many questions. And I think the Chromebook section is still on there. So I was going to say, so Chromebooks, I looked at this fall in detail. They're adding the ability to basically run Linux on them, and you can install Python and you can kind of get there, but I put some time into it and I could set up a dev workflow, but it was pretty hacky. But I think that's changing with like Visual Studio Code and some of these things that will run in the cloud. So in terms of access, it's exciting to me that I think they're getting there where with Chromebook you can do it. I mean, I have a guide up there that does work, but if you go beyond installing Python, like, you know, doing a Django project, it was hard for me to recommend it to someone else. I could do it, but it was pretty painful. But anyways, I'm updating that site because on that site now, I want to, you know, as I said, do that update where I believe, yeah, you, if you're a beginner with Windows, use the Microsoft App Store, otherwise direct. I'm going to update the homebrew section. But I would love to have some sort of section of, you know, there's probably only a dozen different ways to screw it up, but it's the path variables. It's people just, they don't know where Python's located. They don't, you know, they don't understand the command line, and striking that balance of helping them without completely overwhelming them where they, you know, can't get a foot in the door.
Yeah. And the Microsoft App Store, those installers are the same as the download, or not the same as, but they're packaged by the same people who package the Python.org installers. So I'm glad to see that.
But maybe they're getting, it's just the temp drive. There's just a one or two things that are, they don't have full read or write access to, I believe.
Yeah, I'm not super sure about that.
So I wonder if they're going to solve that.
But I was excited on installpython3.com because you recommend Dead Snakes. And I don't know if you listen to Anthony, but I just want to give you a huge shout out. It's like the most appreciated, consistent effort in packaging Python for at least the Ubuntu Debian flavors of Linux. And I generally just reach for that. I used to be a little bit more like the Red Hat side of things, and now I'm just...
Yeah, I do recommend Dead Snakes. This is something, again, I try not to look at all the time, but every 6 months I'm like, okay, what's... Let me put my hat on.
Huge shout out to Anthony. So,
yeah. Well, because I think this is the problem, right, is that... I mean, I was just looking at like RealPython has probably, outside of the Python.org, the most popular guide, and that does quite a good job. But the issue is, I want to install Python. It's like, well, there's 5 different ways, and then, you know, scroll down. It's almost like a recipes app. We have to scroll down all the way, you know, by the time, versus you know, install Python 3 is just like, okay, if you're Googling around for this, you don't know what you're doing, you know, you can sort of trust me, this will get it going, and then you can dive into these debates later on, trying to take a non-engineer approach to the issue, basically. Anyways, yeah, that's always something I like to ask people. I thought you'd be on like Linux or something.
No, my biggest thing was, I think the first time I got a Mac laptop for work, I was suddenly like, I felt relieved of a lot of distraction around, there's a certain amount of like hubris in younger software developers, right? Where it's like, oh, this is software, I can change it. So if you're working on Linux and you don't like something, you know that you can change it. and I fell into that trap.
You need guardrails. Yeah,
I fell into that trap so many times. And so eventually, when I finally got like a Mac computer for work, I was like, well, this is nice. Like I just have to accept that this is the way this thing is. I'm also a big fan of defaults. And so, you know, yeah. Like my vim.rc has one line in it. It's like syntax color. And like my bash profile has like almost nothing in it. And like, you know, I just,
yeah,
this, it's so, it's like, it's okay. It's not perfect. And I people get frustrated when they see that I don't even have like tab expansion open for vim or something. Right. I'm like, well, I just pressed the space bar four times and like, it's okay. And so, yeah, the guardrails is a good way to put it, but yeah, not just accepting like, well, I can't change the way Apple decided to make this decision. So forward.
Yeah. Well, literally this morning or this afternoon for Carlton, I was texting him because I go for my books, I've got these projects and I go through everything on Mac and on Windows. And my Windows machine is, it's old and bad anyway. So typing on it, I just feel kind of angry. So I do have a little bit of a bias against Windows, and I've been told by many people that it's gotten better. And I think maybe if I have a better machine, I won't just like ratchet up my stress every time I have to log into it. Cause most people are the Python survey, more people are on Windows than Mac, obviously. Same with Django.
I'm having fun with Windows for exactly the same reasons that he was saying he likes Mac. Is that
you need to change what you do for fun, man.
No, but like when I pick up a Windows machine, I really don't know what I'm doing, so I can't spend time poodling around in the corners because I'm just like, well, you know, I don't know what happens if I go down there, and it's all in a weird, you've got to learn this whole other shell and this whole other language, and I'll just do what I'm going to do and I get more done. It's brilliant.
And the best part is that somebody has already figured that out. There's somebody for whom it is rewarding to figure out how to accomplish the thing. And so you find them, you use their reference, and then you thank them, and then you just go on with your time. Yeah.
Well, that's farmers and chefs. It's like the analogy I like to make. You know, some people love do one crop, takes years, and they do a really good job. And I'm definitely a chef. I just, you know, get a recipe and maybe I tweak it, but I want to go to the store and just grab stuff. And the creativity is in the combination, not in first principles.
The producing a usable first principle can take a lot of creativity.
For sure. Yeah. It's just what type of creativity do you want to do? Sure. Right. I mean, like, you know, where'd the grain come from? I don't know, but I can make pretty good bread. So I guess it's the last thing. I know we're coming up on time, but so Windows machines. Command line prompt, like Carlton, what does one use, right? There's PowerShell, there's like five different prompts.
If you're on Windows, you use the new Windows Terminal app and you use PowerShell and you learn PowerShell.
Because they have a new cross-platform, I guess PowerShell is now cross-platform.
I haven't got around to installing that on Mac, but you can install PowerShell on Mac now and, you know.
I might try this.
And they've got the whole .NET Core thing is all, you know, cross-platform now. It's available everywhere, so.
If you check your Python version on a Windows machine, it will prompt you to check out the website for, on PowerShell, it'll prompt you to check out. Yeah, I was seeing that this morning. Anyways, last thoughts. Anaconda. So, E, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, I'll tell you, it's fantastic. It's bundled together. I've recommended people not use that, but a lot of teachers say just use that because it is a little bit simpler. If you're starting out.
So Anaconda is ultimately solving a larger problem than pip does, right? Anaconda is solving not just how to install Python packages, but also how to install all of the things necessary to make that Python package work. And so it is a larger problem space, and it's represented in the amount of, you know, labor and investment that has gone into creating Anaconda. So, you know, I personally have not used it much, but you know, it does solve so many of the issues that you run into with, you know, software library requirements and dependencies that are not Python based. Yeah. At the end of the day, pip stands for pip installs Python packages. And that is really what its goal is. And so until such a time where, you know, the broader Python packaging ecosystem has a solution for explicitly declaring how to install dependencies that aren't Python, you know, the solution really is something akin to Anaconda. But when you look at the CondaForge project, which is also volunteer-driven or foundation-driven or community-driven, CondaForge has an immense effort to produce the results that it does. And they speak for themselves. It is truly like the easiest way to install some of the, you know, more complex projects out there. So,
yeah. Well, and there's the mini Conda flavor too, which is what I found was the best on a Chromebook. So it's, as you say, it's a whole ecosystem. We had the PyCharm folks on a little bit recently, again, thinking of, you know, beyond just Python. So if you use Django with PyCharm, it comes with a whole lot of other goodies.
Yeah, and there's like
that make a lot of sense, and it's a lot of investment to make that happen. As you
and
say.
Then another shout out there would be along the lines like PyWheels. So Ben Nuttall produces this project called PyWheels, and this is, you know, an index of wheels that are pre built for installation on the Raspberry Pi.
Yeah.
And that's a really interesting solution to a very specific target. For installing, you know, complex Python packages. And Wheel itself produces the ability to target that specifically. And so I think that the components are there, and the ecosystem, you know, there are so many people involved in the wide open Python packaging ecosystem that building consensus and building a direct way forward to start defining and maintaining these specifiers, you know, and starting to roll that out and building standards that everyone can comply to. I think that provides a really good opportunity in the future for Wheels to step in to cover some of those bases. I don't think there will be a point where I guess maybe this is pessimism, but it doesn't feel like there will ever be a point where the volunteer and community-driven Python packaging standards meet every single niche use case and match every single expectation that you know certain people would have. And so, but I think that there's the building blocks in place for us to see a solution that meets 80% of those needs, or much more, honestly, you know, with time. I'm a big fan of Wheels myself. So
this is really interesting topic because, you know, I'm a Python user, you know, and I work on Django and, you know, but the Python packaging landscape just confuses the heck out of me. And, you know, I'm a quote unquote expert. And
I am an expert in one part of the Python packaging ecosystem.
But right, yeah. you've got that, you know. But I'm not an expert on packaging. But I'm, you know, I'm supposed to, and I'm just like, I you know, what's going on with, you know, setup.config versus PyTOML, PyProject.toml? I don't know. I see all these peps come out, and it's like, and I kind of nice to hear you say that you think it will come together and meet the, you know, 80% plus. Use case.
I think we're already at 80% plus. I mean, for a lot of stuff, but I just think there's what's necessary in place to see a better story with time, and a lot of that will just come down to facilitating conversations and building consensus, I think.
So, as a last question, if you, in your role at the PSF, if you had, you know, the power to do whatever you wanted, what's on your wish list for, you know, fixing ongoing stuff or new projects that would be fun to tackle?
Ooh. I have to admit that you've caught me in one of the busiest times of the year. So
sitting on a beach doing nothing, or sitting wherever doing nothing
right now we've got PyCon coming up in about 5 weeks, and so you know that sort of turns into an all hands on deck amongst the PSF staff as well as all the PyCon volunteers, and so you know that's very much like what's top of stack right now.
But I
think as far as what the PSF does, if I could wave a magic wand and have something fixed, I think it would be along the lines of, you know, the way that we communicate and engage with the community and let them know not only what we're up to, but also what we can, you know, how we can be there for them. So, but again, the most recent hire actually is sort of on that fundraising,
dedicated fundraising,
and that inherently requires some of that work. And so I'm really excited to see where that goes, because I think to a lot of folks, the PSF is a little bit, you know, they just sort of assume it has something to do with Python that's really important. And I agree, but not necessarily in the way that most people would infer.
Well, I think Django has the same issues. I mean, in terms of most people don't know about the DSF, I'd imagine. They don't need to, but how can we communicate, you know, the good things, things where we need help on, you know, growth areas. I mean, obviously, when a new version comes out, we can announce that. But it's hard to corral volunteers to do that kind of thing and figure out what's the balance between pestering people and I don't know. I think we could do more, but it's hard to say. I mean, we're very, very careful with how we use Twitter, very careful with blog posts and anything official. So much so that, I mean, this podcast is Carlton and me just on our own. There's a Django News newsletter I do with Jeff Triplett, but that's deliberately separate from Django, because like who at the DSF in a volunteer capacity would do a newsletter? Like it's a bit of work. So there's all these things that I think contribute on the edges and are better off there than being consumed within Django itself. But yeah, at the same time, you know, we had just added, I guess, last thing I'm proud of, and I keep constantly plugging, there's a forum, djangoproject.com. Is that the URL, Carlton?
Yeah.
The Django forum.
Yeah,
forum. Yeah. You know, that has a lot of really smart people on it as a, you know, way for people to ask questions. And it gets traffic, but it doesn't have anywhere near what it could. I mean, if people knew that if they asked there as opposed to Stack Overflow, they would have, you know, the right people answering it. But it's just not used as much as it could or should be. Less elegant way of saying I agree, communication is tough for Django as well.
Absolutely. No, but I think that one of the first times I became deeply aware of the DSF was when the Django Fellows program was announced, and that has continued to be, you know, a really interesting and apparently fruitful way of, you know, providing value to the community. So definitely tip.
Well, there's a new CPython fellow or something that, like that, right? Coming
that just so the job posting for that just went out yesterday. So the Python Software Foundation has gotten the opportunity through funding to fund somebody to work on CPython, and it's the first time PSF will have gotten that opportunity. So it's really exciting, and you know, again, I think that it offers the opportunity, like I said, for people to recognize, like, oh, this is like a much more tangible thing for software oriented minds anyway, to understand, oh, they're doing something. And so, yeah, I think the Django Fellow program is, you know, very similar in that, you know, I became aware of the DSF even because of it. So hopefully that'll help us with our messaging as well.
Well, we've been lucky. We're 3 for 3, I would say, with fellows. So I know it's coming. We'll have a fellow that requires a little bit of handholding from the board, but not yet. In any event, thank you for making the time. I know you got a lot that you do anyways, and then all the planning. We didn't even get to talk about you were a U.S. chair for PyCon, at least 2019, I think a couple years before that,
it was
right?
2018, so, 2019, and it was honestly one of the biggest honors of my life.
Yeah, I remember seeing you running around a lot during that, as all the staff are at these events. So thank you. Appreciate you taking the time.
Absolutely. I really appreciate y'all. And this was so calming and relaxing, and you're very pleasant to talk to. So honestly,
it's Carlton. Everyone always tells me, they're like, you know, well, it's okay, but who's that Carlton person? His voice, he sounds smart. Like, oh,
I should move to America.
Spain, they don't dig the British.
No. It doesn't come across.
Doesn't inflect your Spanish with or your Catalan with extra gravitas.
No. It only goes across in the other side of the pond.
Well, E, thank you again.
Yeah, thank you.
DjangoChat.com, chatdjango on Twitter, and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.